Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome everybody to another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mark's Medical Podcast. Today we are talking nausea and vomiting with our resident emergency specialist, Dr. Dinesh Pelipana. Welcome, Dinesh.
Hello, thanks for having me again.
Thank you for coming in. Matt, how are you?
I'm normal.
You don't feel sick, nauseated?
Not yet.
Ready to spew anywhere?
We've got new microphones though.
Yeah, hopefully everyone's enjoying the sound and can finally hear us for once.
I should probably clarify too that I'm an emergency resident.
Sorry, emergency resident. You're a physician.
His qualifications and accolades change every time we get in.
Yeah, last he was a lawyer last week, right?
Order Australia.
Yeah, that's it. We'll see what he comes up with next time.
It'll be a knight.
That's the plan.
A knight of the Commonwealth. That's right. We said able seaman last time, didn't we? So today we're talking nausea and vomiting. So we might just jump straight into it and start talking about some of the pathophysiology. I think what we should begin with is that we should highlight that there is a part of the brain in the brain stem.
So what is it first?
What vomiting is. You can tell everyone what vomiting is.
Well, start with nausea.
Okay, what's nausea?
The feeling of wanting to vomit? I don't know. What is the technical definition?
Sounds good to me.
Dinesh?
I guess it's an unpleasant feeling that... Yeah, makes you feel like you want to vomit, or people generally describe it as feeling sick.
Is what's the term retching?
Retching.
Is that considered part of nausea, or is that closer to part of vomiting?
I think retching's more pre-vomiting. Right?
Okay.
Yeah, people sort of.
It's sort of vomiting without the actual emesis, right? Without the vomit.
Okay, so emesis is the technical term for vomiting.
Yeah.
And so vomiting is essentially the evacuation of your gastric contents.
Yes.
But possibly other things can come up alongside that, right?
Yeah, and Dinesh will hopefully give us a few examples as to what may be coming up once you've emptied your gastric contents and some other things.
Like intestinal contents.
Yes, whether it's proximal or distal.
Ooh, okay. And so vomiting is a coordinated interaction of neural, humeral, I guess, being in,
yeah,
the,
what's
blood
in the blood,
and muscle. So it's a very... coordinate an event that requires you, which we can go through. Do we need to do the motor movements first, or
yeah,
should we talk about what causes it?
Let's talk about what causes it, and then we can say once it's been stimulated, what happens physiologically to bring all those contents up, and then we can jump into.
So we know that we have a respiratory center that dictates how we breathe and how long we breathe for, and how quick we breathe and how deep and shallow we breathe. We know we have a cardiovascular center that dictates how fast our heart is and so forth. So do we have a similar center for vomiting?
Yes, we have the vomiting center that sits in the medulla,
and that's the lowest portion of our brainstem.
Okay.
And that vomiting center will be having a discussion with a number of motor centers as well, which then send that efferent signal, which is a signal out and away from the brain,
okay,
to coordinate a patterned contractile event that results in emesis.
So the actual outcome of using all those muscles to somehow get all that evacuation out of your stomach.
That's it.
Okay, so there's a center in your medulla,
yeah,
that dictates the efferent flow.
That's
right. Is that right?
That's right.
Is it so? Just the one.
It's the one. It's the one center. But okay, there's a conversation needs to be had between, or can be had between, multiple signals coming into this center, and so these afferent signals, mm-hmm, coming towards the vomit center can be, for example, they can come from another part of the medulla called the chemoreceptive trigger zone. Have you heard of the chemoreceptive trigger zone?
I usually refer to that as a CTZ.
Really? Look at that. You always...
I like that. That's good.
So why is it called that?
It's called the chemoreceptive trigger zone because it's an area of the brain. It actually, like I said, sits at the medulla, but actually sits outside of the blood-brain barrier, which means it's very sensitive to what's floating around in the bloodstream and also what's floating around in the CSF.
And so was it ever named that because of its sensitivity to chemotherapy, or did that just come on?
No, I just assumed because it's sensitive to chemicals floating, okay, around in the bloodstream. And okay, so those types of chemicals include opiates, cannabinoids, noradrenaline, histamine, substance P, serotonin, dopamine, acetylcholine. There's a whole bunch of chemicals.
Various toxins.
Toxins as well.
Like what? Alcohol?
We
have this discussion about alcohol, okay? And so, you know, drink too much, you're going to spew. Now, we were discussing what it is about the alcohol that makes you vomit. And so we said it could be potentially two things. Both could be wrong. Maybe both could be right. Maybe it's something else. That the alcohol quickly gets absorbed from the stomach and the rest of the GIT, small intestines, into the bloodstream pretty quick.
As ethanol.
And then the liver metabolizes it to acetaldehyde pretty quickly and some other byproducts, which that itself is probably what's stimulating the chemoreceptive trigger zone. Or...
So the byproducts of alcohol?
The byproducts of alcohol are potentially, mm-hmm, doing it. Or maybe if you are ingesting a significant amount of ethanol in a single go, that's irritating the bowel, and that direct irritation could be sending afferents to the, not the chemoreceptive trigger zone, but the vomiting center in the medulla. What do you think?
Via the vagus nerve.
Via the vagus.
Mm.
You reckon both? One? Either?
I would imagine it's a combination of both. But
yeah, yeah, I would think so.
I haven't read up on it, though.
No. Yeah. I haven't read up on it either, but that's my hypothesis.
The other thing you could possibly add from a hormonal standpoint is potentially pregnancy. So,
yes.
Oh yeah. So HCG, which stands for, I never can get
human chorionic gonadotropin,
which is the one that they use for the pregnancy test. But as that increases, presumably that then acts on the trigger zone.
Okay. Mm. And so once this chemoreceptive trigger zone has been activated by any one or combination of these chemicals,
yeah,
it then sends a signal to the vomiting center
right
next door in the medulla, and this stimulates, like I said, that patterned motor response that results in emesis, vomiting.
Okay.
What's some other ways that we can stimulate the vomit center?
Well, you spoke about the coming from the actual gut itself.
Mm.
So you could have in the GIT either a mechano or chemical. So if the GIT is probably stretched or distended excessively, that could be the mechano part,
mm-hmm,
or chemical, if there is mucosal irritation or other kind of irritations.
What about obstruction?
I just said that.
You said distension.
Well, that,
you said
from the obstruction.
Oh, gotcha.
So sorry, if you're, let's say your pyloric sphincter was to be narrowed like through a stenosis. I guess this is more for a child or an infant, but maybe it could happen with an adult. So the stomach can't empty itself and will become distended. Maybe that would...
Do you often see obstructions resulting in vomiting? GRT obstructions?
Yeah, you can. You can definitely see obstructions of various sorts causing vomiting, and that is a really important cause that you need to look for. We'll talk about causes a bit later on, but obstruction is definitely something because there's a mechanical barrier that's stopping contents from getting through.
And so Matt said distension. Could that distension be caused due to maybe excessive gas? Could excessive gas, maybe whether it be if somebody is a celiac, or whether they've got an overproduction of microbiota that's breaking things down excessively, can you vomit because of excessive gas within the bowel? Is that something you've seen?
No, I don't think so. It's so a lot of farming, yeah, if there's actually a mechanical problem that's causing it, then yes. But if it's so you can get distension from mechanical blockages, but things like gas just tend to pass through.
Yeah,
the other end.
Yeah,
which we'll do another time when we do diarrhea.
We're just going to do. Oh, we'll do diarrhea. Okay.
And then I guess there's infection. So you've got your gastroenteritis, which could be viral or bacterial, which probably is toxic, or the mucosal irritant.
So you say, Matt, that so these some of these causes at the GRT itself, which is triggering us to vomit. So it has to be sent to the brain, right? Sent to the medulla. So how's that happening?
Well, that's via the afferents of the vagal nerve. So so that's a sensory, visceral sensory sensation going back to the brain from the vagus nerve, because the vagus does a lot of the...
That's a parasympathetic nerve. That's a 10th cranial nerve.
Yes, that's right.
Let's not forget the vestibular system too.
Oh, yeah.
The only other thing I was going to add to that, but that's a good next one, is that some of the cells in the GIT... when they are irritated or annoyed or have problems, they actually produce serotonin themselves, which can then act on receptors on the vagus nerve.
Well, there's an equivalent amount of serotonin produced in the gut as there is in the brain, if not more. Mm-hmm. And serotonin seems to be a really strong trigger for vomiting, at least at the chemoreceptive trigger zone.
Yep.
But like you said, to stimulate the vagus to send afferents up to the brain.
So it can impact that, yeah. So, sorry, Dinesh, go into your vestibular system.
Yes. So, with the vestibular, this is going to be basically our center that picks up motion and balance within the head, right? So, if the vestibular system... So, us knowing where we are in our own space is proprioception. Our vestibular system is allowing us to sort of keep balance and have that motion of the head. And then we also have another afferent of sight coming in. And all these things sort of work together to allow us to probably not be unbalanced.
Coordinate movement, basically.
So if any one of these three things, and please tell me if there's something I've missed out, mismatches with the other... then you can sort of get like a motion sickness sort of thing. Now, is this something that you commonly see as causing nausea and vomit?
Yeah. So with people with vertigo, or people can also just get motion sickness.
Yeah. Would they present very common?
With vertigo?
No.
Motion sickness. Because it's usually pretty self-limiting.
Yeah. Don't come into the ED too often.
Exactly. I went on a date once. I went on this spinny ride at
the
park.
Is this a presentation or is this you?
This is me.
Well, keep going. I'm interested.
In the bin.
And that was the end of the date.
Yeah, very sexy.
Yeah, I was just going to say, perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, that's very self-limiting.
That was the teacup ride.
Yeah, that's right. So that's part of the motion sickness, but like you said, quite self-limiting.
I'll just say something there, that that nerve or that neural impulse goes to its own little nuclei, which is the vestibular nuclei, which is also in the brainstem. Mm. But that has an impact with acetylcholine and histamine. So that might come into play a bit later when we talk about drugs that are used for antinemics.
Okay, so that's a good point. So all these things we've spoken about, so stimulating the chemoreceptive trigger zone, afferent coming from the gut, primarily via the vagus nerve. We haven't really spoken about... Did we talk about the involvement of perception in the cerebral cortex?
No, we haven't.
Okay, so...
But we can get to that.
As a final point...
Well, just while we're finishing that point off, there's an area that goes into the vomiting center, which they also call the tractus solitarius.
Mm.
And that's kind of like an analog to taste. Like at least lower vertebrates, they have really, like say fish, they have really big tractus solitarises, which because they sense a lot of their body through taste, or they their skin tastes for them. So they have a huge taste centre in their head, their brain. Ours is kind of sit in near the vomiting centre or coordinates with the vomiting centre. So anything like the vagus going in, glossopharyngeal going in, so glossopharyngeal, which is number nine, that that will take taste with it, and so will facial. So there's a bit of taste there, and also the vestibular, and that kind of all together goes into that tractus, which then...
So you're saying, so if there's something that you taste going into the central nervous system that potentially your central nervous system may not agree with and think this may be toxic, maybe, or whatever it may be, that could then trigger the vomiting center.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's through a perceptual taste that you've been reinforced by.
Yeah.
Or if it's just a general chemical taste.
Mm.
But also in the glossopharyngeal vagus, you also have the gag reflex. So that's a mechanico stimulus in the back of your throat.
Through the tractus solitarius.
I believe it does.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, talking to that point, I got food poisoning a couple of weeks ago. Or at least I think it was. Maybe it was a gastro bug. But regardless, I vomited after I ate some capsicum. And I love capsicum, right? So I ate it.
So you can't eat capsicum now?
I have not been able to eat capsicum since. I love it. And I went back to it and I was so nauseated by the thought of eating capsicum, even though I love it. And I just went, wow. There's that whole cerebral cortex playing a role in perception, how that perception alters. Well, can talk to the medulla and say, you may vomit if you keep going ahead with this.
So that's the high center.
That's the highest center.
Which comes through experience, maybe.
Yeah. So it potentially can be altered.
So like I was talking to you earlier, with your daughter, she's probably too far now, but maybe a younger infant, if you gave them a plate of poo, they would probably...
Father of the year.
They would probably, potentially, they potentially could eat it. Right.
Potentially.
Well, some infants wipe their poo over themselves, right?
Yeah.
Because they don't really have that association that it's that horrible.
Yeah.
But if you were to give it to an adult, there's no way that they could possibly eat it, right? They would be vomiting. They'd be gagging to even get it close to them.
Well, I think the person putting... Not all adults? you've seen a couple of things? Okay, that's
anyway,
maybe glad you brought that up.
Bad example.
All right, so we've
you get the point.
We get the point. So we've got the fact that we've got the chemoreceptor trigger zone picking up things in the blood and CSF that can stimulate vomiting. We've got our perception that can stimulate vomiting. We've got the vestibular system that can stimulate vomiting. And we've also got afferents coming from the gut that can stimulate vomiting.
And did you finish all the cerebral ones? So
you've got smell, sight, taste. Would be the predominant ones.
And just thought, right?
And just the thought of it, like the thought of eating capsicum.
Well, that, but maybe also just emotional state. So you'd see that, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Like,
if you're very anxious. Exactly. If you're very anxious. I mean, there are psychogenic causes for nausea and vomiting.
Mm.
So if you're very anxious or if you're, there are certain emotional states that can certainly make you feel quite sick or even make you vomit, really.
Wow.
Yeah.
I suppose there are people that vomit before they do a big presentation, for example.
Exactly.
Not me. I don't get nervous.
But whether that's to do with the presentation or maybe an autonomic, like an adrenaline rush.
We see noradrenaline stimulates the chemoreceptor trigger zone, so maybe they have a...
Yeah, well, there are autonomic consequences of your emotions.
Mm.
So it can certainly upset what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so that's basically...
That's the patho.
That's what's causing it.
Yep.
And then just quickly a motor, or how the muscles are coordinated to cause the vomit itself. So, a few steps here. So, the first thing that potentially will start is your thoracic, diaphragmatic, and abdominal muscles will start to contract. And that usually starts to contract against a closed glottis, which is your kind of top part of your airway.
Yeah.
That will build pressure up in particularly your intra-abdominal area.
Mm-hmm.
So that's below the diaphragm. And then what happens, that could lead to the retching. Again, is that right, Tern?
Yeah, retching. Have you never said the word retching?
I thought it was reaching.
Reaching? That's when you got to grab something.
Okay. Step two, so then the next thing to happen is your lower esophageal sphincter will start to relax in combination with your diaphragm, but the crural part. So the diaphragm has kind of muscular feet that kind of overlaps your blood vessels and goes into your kind of the bodies of your vertebra.
Yes.
So they would have to kind of relax. This will allow food to start to go up into your esophagus. And then that with your...
The diaphragm also plays a minor role in stopping reflux and regurgitation of your gastric contents into the esophagus, because obviously the esophagus is above the diaphragm and the stomach is below the diaphragm and it moves through that crura. And so...
Probably that crura itself is probably that. Some shape plays a physiological role too.
Mm. Well, the lower esophageal sphincter is a pretty pathetic sphincter. Yeah. So many people get not often a term I use. Yeah, I get gastroesophageal reflux all the time. I've got a pathetic lower esophageal sphincter.
All right. Dinesh is just looking at him funny. Okay, and so then we get those sphincters relaxing in combination of the intra-abdominal pressure increasing.
Yeah.
But then we have moved into step three, which is a very coordinated event with your breathing muscles. So normally the way that you breathe to allow the pressure in your thorax to change to allow breathing to air to go in and then go back out would allow the pressures to go from up to down. But you have to reverse that in the vomiting. So the way that the inspiratory versus expiratory muscles are driving allows the thorax, as the vomit's going through the esophagus, as it's going in your thorax, the pressure changes in your lungs have to kind of push it up and out. It
permits regurgitation as opposed to,
Whilst this is happening, your pharyngeal muscles, which would probably be more vagal and glossopharyngeal driven, has to coordinate. You want it to go out, but you don't want it to be aspirated.
So you want it to go out your mouth, but not down your trachea.
Right, exactly. Right. So you need to coordinate your upper pharyngeal muscles and your probably epiglottis in a way that all the vomit will go flying out your mouth.
Which it does.
Which it hopefully does. Which
you did the other week.
But
it can even go behind you. I don't know how that's possible. But I vomit and it ends up being in places that my mouth wasn't even facing. I don't know how that happens.
Okay. But whilst this pharyngeal motor control is occurring, it doesn't do well with the higher parts. So it will come out your nose.
Mm.
So you're kind of... I'm just trying to think of the term. The uvula and the areas that prevent when you swallow stuff going up into your nose, that I guess is turned off.
Okay, what's the last part? What about what's happening at the intestines? You got reverse peristalsis happening?
Well, interestingly, normally with peristalsis, that's driven quite strongly by your enteric nervous system, which is its own little brain, if you want to use that, right? Yeah, so I think there's more neurons in your enteric system than your spinal cord.
Yeah, or approximately equivalent.
Okay, so it usually generates how you process your movement in your gut normally. But during this vomit process, it's totally overconsumed by your external nerves, so like your vagus. And so it will override it and shoot it backwards the other way.
Cool.
Is that enough? Do you think
I think that's heaps.
Okay.
Before we all start retching.
Reaching, yes.
Reaching. All right, so let's
bring in the expert now.
All right, let's start talking clinical.
So my first question to you, Dinesh, so we're working in a ED context mostly today in this podcast. So we're doing nausea and vomiting in a context of ED.
Yeah.
So if you had a patient present to you with nausea and vomiting, let's just say that's all you know at this point.
Yeah.
What would you say the top five, 10 causes 20, of it?
30, top 30 causes?
Causes would be?
If you were just going to guess.
Yeah. So if you didn't know anything else about this patient, you just know that there's someone there with nausea and vomiting. There's still a very broad range of things that can cause it. Mm. But some of the most common things might be gastroenteritis.
Okay. Like I ate a bad capsicum.
Like a bad capsicum.
It probably wasn't a capsicum. I think it was.
I hope not. I really hope not for you.
I know, I love capsicum.
And your reputation.
It's true. I've been a big capsicum eater.
Pregnancy would be another one.
Unknown?
Sometimes, yeah. Okay. Sometimes it could be.
And is there anything classical in that presentation? Like, is it usually a morning?
Well, it's is female.
Yeah, okay, that's a good start.
It could be morning, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But it's not, I mean, it doesn't always have to be. Yeah. It's a young female.
And a recurring vomit. They're like, I just keep vomiting for some reason. I don't know why.
It could be, yeah. Okay. Another one is, so you could get drug-induced, whether it be like prescription drugs or other drugs.
And is there any drug in particular that's a big candidate?
So opiates can cause vomiting, and that's because they alter your motility. But cannabis can also cause a very unique type of emesis as well.
Yeah, so that's because so, what do you mean by unique?
Yeah.
So you can get, and I remember this because one of the consultants in our emergency department, when I was in medical school, he taught us this. But essentially, if you have a really high consumption of cannabis over a period of time, you can get cannabinoid-induced hyperemesis.
Yeah. Okay.
And sometimes, classically, these guys like to shower a lot.
Ah.
So if you get someone who's vomiting
whilst in the shower
a lot, and then you ask them, have you been showering a lot?
Yeah.
And they say yes. And then you say, do you smoke?
Does it matter how they, what's the correct term? Because you could smoke it, but if they ingest it as well?
It's edible or smoked.
Yeah, yeah. Does that impact it? It doesn't really matter.
I don't think it matters, but I think you need a fairly high amount of cannabis.
I think so, because usually cannabis is used to stop nausea, right? At least medicinally.
It has been, I don't know how strong the body of evidence is, but it has been trialed.
At least it's been prescribed for it, whether it works or not. Well, I mean, it definitely helps you eat. You know,
if sure does. Yeah.
If maybe you need to get some nourishment, it may help.
Okay.
So, so gastroenteritis, pregnancy, drugs, pharmaceutical and recreational.
Mm-hmm.
On the same token, you could probably get things like vertigo as well. People feel quite nauseous.
That runs in my family.
I get vertigo.
Do you?
Yeah, it's horrible.
For any reason? It just comes on and goes?
It just happens. Lay down sometimes and then just start flipping around the room.
And I mean, vertigo is also, I guess, there are causes for vertigo, which is probably it. Discussion for another day, but the vertiginous.
I've had it a couple of times. I think I've got a floater in my ear. Like, apparently that you get these like little stones that can, and they can then press on the hairs, which tell your vestibular system that you're doing something different.
And there are certain maneuvers you can do to move it out of place.
Is that where you like grab the head and you like throw it to the side or something?
Doesn't it diagnose and treat at the same time?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
There's vertigo, and then migraines. People get nausea with migraines.
Do we know the mechanism underlying that?
I think migraines. So I think this is the additional ones. I'm not sure if this is 100% correct, but I think migraines, increased intracranial pressure, like things like meningitis, can present. So that could be maybe a trigeminal painful input. So whether it wouldn't be through the cortex way,
no,
but it would be, I mean, trigeminal is usually the sensory.
But it could be because the cortex is neuronal changes within the cortex definitively occur during migraine, and so that dysregulation leads to a whole bunch of ion movements which may impact. I mean, for example, my sister who gets migraines, she will self-induce emesis and she feels better as soon as she's had a bit of a chuck.
My understanding is just a direct, because the trigeminal nerve, which does pick up pain from the head, like meninges, blood vessels, all that, will go direct, well, it kind of goes into the brainstem and it goes from the midbrain all the way down to the medulla. Mm. So probably, and I think also tumours are in there as well.
Mm. Yeah. But, I mean, look, the...
Brain tumours, that is.
Yeah. So, the causes for nausea and vomiting are very broad. And I guess when you get isolated nausea and vomiting, those could be some of the things. But
all right, well let's just say now, if a person does present with nausea and vomiting, what are you going to do from that point?
Okay, so first of all, you look at the person, and you know, just from the bit of paper that you get before you go see them, mm-hmm. you'll know whether they're a male or a female.
Yeah.
You'll know whether they're young or old, or even an infant. And that's already going to give you a set of things to start thinking about.
So if we, would it be best to then, for us now to, would you have, let's just say an infant comes in.
Yeah.
Have you automatically now categorized a subset of causes? Like, do you straight away go, all right, it's an infant, so it's probably going to be some sort of gastroenteritis or obstruction?
Or pyloric stenosis, yeah. or you know, all sorts of things. But then, I guess among all the age groups, one of the things that can be quite common is gastroenteritis. Yeah. So that's
mm-hmm.
probably one. I mean, hopefully, infants not smoking cannabis.
Yes, or at least not too much.
Yeah.
No, none at all. Obviously, don't condone infants smoking cannabis or ingesting cannabis.
We're responsible.
That's very true.
But, yeah, so just knowing some of those things before you even start seeing a patient.
And so if...
help you think about.
Do you always ask them, I'm sure you do, how long have you been vomiting
before? Absolutely. So if it's, you know, an hours to a day or even a couple of days, it's more acute, right?
Yeah.
But then there are people that have had it for weeks or months.
Vomiting for weeks.
They can have nausea and vomiting for weeks. And that can indicate... you know, more functional gastrointestinal disorders like gastroparesis. Yeah.
What does that mean?
So things aren't moving along as they should.
And that's the whole GIT?
Yeah, and that I think that those type of things require endoscopies and other studies to really identify what's going on.
Right.
Yeah. You can also get things like cyclical vomiting syndrome where, you know, you get... it's exactly as it sounds. So it happens in cycles in a predictable fashion for a period of so
what was that, psychogenic?
You know, I can't remember the exact
So when you spoke about the ones that go in more with a dysfunction of the GIT, would that mean that the vomiting will come generally when you eat or in a pattern of when they've ingested something?
Potentially, but it's they have chronic nausea and vomiting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Constant. Okay. All right.
But also, you know, some of the literature says that if it's straight after you eat, it could be indicative of more psychogenic causes as well.
Mm.
So it's something to think about.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, splitting it up into acute and chronic helps you deal with it. And a lot of the time, people that have chronic symptoms won't show up to the emergency department, but they'll be under investigation, you know, and sometimes no cause can be found, in which case you'll put it down to something else.
Yeah.
But so in the acute setting, there are definitely a wide range of differentials that you need to keep in mind. And like I said, having the age range gives you a bit of an idea of what to think of.
So would you say that the majority... now, again, I did this last time and it's unfair when I ask you to put a statistic on because you haven't looked at the stats for it, right? But I'm just getting you to guess.
Yeah.
Would the majority be gastroenteritis?
You know, yeah, like you said, I don't know if there are any stats on it.
Yeah.
And I don't know of any, but, you know, it's quite common.
Yeah.
It's common across all the age ranges. It's common across, you know, if it's acute and isolated, it would almost certainly be just that.
And would you say that if it's less than 24 hours,
mm-hmm.
potentially you'd be thinking, okay, it's gastroenteritis, hasn't run its course yet. But if it's 3 days, would you then start thinking, maybe not gastroenteritis? Or do you have gastroenteritis cases that last up to a week?
Yeah, you can have gastroenteritis that can last up to 7 to 10 days even. Yeah.
Okay.
So... just knowing a bit more detail about them, you know, okay, I just got back from Indonesia.
Gotcha. And I drank water.
Yeah, and I ate raw chicken.
Yeah, gotcha.
From a street vendor.
As you do.
As you do.
But then you need to keep your eye out for some red flag conditions as well.
So what would that be?
So the important things to think about.
Are we just talking generally now?
Generally, okay. Yeah.
So asking about the vomit itself, you know, is important. So did you have any blood, or particularly if it's like coffee ground type?
So what would that mean if it's coffee ground?
So it could mean that they have an upper GI bleed.
So what is it about the upper GI bleed manifesting as coffee grounds in the vomit? Is that just because it's dried blood?
Digested.
Digested blood. It's okay. Yeah. So it's black and looks like coffee grains.
Yeah, it's dark.
Dark.
Yeah.
And is that, do you have a different concern if it's fresh blood compared to the...
So if they've got fresh blood, I mean, if it's profuse fresh blood and they're sort of hemodynamically unstable, you might be worried that there's a significant tear or a significant disruption to the mucosa. But if it's just, you know, a streak of blood here and there, then it's probably just something trivial that's going to resolve itself.
Like maybe a tear or something from the vomiting.
Yeah, like a Mallory Weiss tear is what it's called.
Okay, and is that an esophageal?
Mm.
Yeah, okay.
Would
you get more profuse bleeding if it's something like an ulcer, a gastric ulcer? Is that something you see? You don't really get vomiting with gastric ulcers.
Potentially, yeah. So those kind of questions are really important to ask.
Yes.
So with an upper GI bleed, you might also get melena, which is dark stools.
Oh, okay.
So what discerns between, let's say you have an upper GI bleed. My understanding was, there's kind of a ligament, I think it's called ligament of Treitz, which I can never get this right, but if the bleed is above that, proximal to that, it will be melena.
Yeah.
But if it's distal to that, it will become a frank blood stool. But that point is, let's say, in the midway of the duodenum. So that's the first part of the small intestine. But what would dictate it going, a bleed, at, let's say in the duodenum, to go out as poo versus what going out as vomit? Does it have to be, for a vomit, does it have to have an obstruction?
Oh, well, you could get both.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you could get both. You could have, but I mean, but if it's vomit, it's usually more proximal. You would imagine if you're getting coffee ground vomits, it'll
stomach.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so but
if it's, you know, a lot of people just have melena.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And so if a question with the blood would be, you know, what your stool's like potentially.
Yeah. So it's an associated question that you might ask. Have you had melena as well?
And so if you were to have an obstruction, let's say in your small bowel, there is that potential that you can vomit out a fecal kind of.
Yeah, we can get like gastrocolic fistulas where you're, So.
Because we spoke about it. Remember I said my friend had, not him, but.
Say the story, yeah.
He just had there was a guy.
Don't say it dismissively. It's insane.
Okay, so this guy, when he was drinking alcohol at the bar, he would belch and everyone would leave the room because it was that bad. And so he wanted to investigate that. And so he went to a gastroenterologist who did an endoscopy and found that he had a stomach ulcer, but it burnt through the wall and it went, because one of the intestines that kind of run just near the stomach is the transverse colon, and just made a fistula straight into the transverse colon.
That's pretty significant.
So there was a fistula. Yeah. So communication between the large bowel and the stomach. So he was
burping up his poo.
No, he's just farting out his mouth.
Well, there you go. Yeah, farting out his mouth. How's that? That's lucky, though, that it didn't go into the peritoneum.
Or didn't hit a blood vessel and
bleed
out, I guess.
You know, not get septic and...
I mean, you can get fistulas between all sorts of stuff.
True.
Which is... But, identifying the causes and making sure that there are no red flag things are important. And you're going to be kind of guided by the patient's demographics and their background and history. So even things like a myocardial infarction can cause nausea, a stroke, could cause.
And is this because of chemicals that are released from the damaged tissue?
Or do we not really know?
From a myocardial infarction, I would think that it's probably more the autonomic dysfunction that would cause it.
Yeah.
So you could have a vagal afferent.
Also the pain, right? Pain causes nausea.
Yeah. Maybe multiple effects.
It's
unlikely to just get isolated nausea and vomiting, you know, but it's probably going to be associated with chest pain or something else. Stroke, you know, particularly if it's affecting the brainstem.
Yeah.
What about, I mean, this kind of hybridizes our last discussion when you did abdominal pain. But if the person's got nausea and vomiting and then a distinct pain location,
yeah.
Can that guide you? Like, so if, let's say you had it in a region that you think, oh, maybe that could be now a gallbladder or a stone.
Like if it's right up a quadrant or epigastric, you know, pancreatitis, for example. If they got appendicitis-like pain, so umbilic, or that's migrating down to the right iliac fossa, then it could be appendicitis for sure. So there's such a vast range of differentials for appendicitis, and taking a thorough history of the actual complaint, so time course, associated symptoms, all that kind of stuff is really important, but then also getting a medical history as well to see, you know, I mean, are you on chemotherapy, for example?
Yes.
Do you have any other, do you even have your gallbladder?
Yeah.
Sometimes. So all those kind of things are really important. Then a social history is very important. So, you know, if this person's smoking weed every single day and or has a pattern of change to their weed, do they abuse opioids? Are they a big drinker? Because that can be a cause of pancreatitis.
Yeah.
So even asking about their employment, because sometimes it can give you hints to whether they're exposed to certain toxins.
Ah,
okay. So all these things are really important to getting an idea.
So how often would you say at the end of all this, so obviously, so you'd say that vomiting is a sign of probably something else.
Yeah.
How often do you get just idiopathic nausea and vomiting, unknown origin?
Yeah. So you can get it. A lot of the time, nausea and vomiting comes in, you know, like I said, associated with something. Mm. So it could be the manifestation of gastroenteritis, or it could be associated with other things, like a myocardial infarction. But idiopathic, like nausea and vomiting without any other cause found, I think it's reasonably rare.
Yeah.
And it probably gets more seen in the chronic setting.
Gotcha.
With different types of
specialists. So does nausea and vomiting usually only last the duration of the disease or disorder? Or could you, because you know how you can sort of get some lasting effects of certain diseases and disorders. Do people ever, they had gastroenteritis or they had something, but they're still vomiting or nauseated. Is that something that happens? Or does it usually just last the duration of the disease?
Usually.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Makes sense.
Just one last.
Yeah. What and then we'll talk about treatment.
What physical examinations would you do?
Yeah.
Like what common physical exams might you run?
Again, it's going to be.
Again, depending on all the other things you've done.
So one of the things that you want to assess from a general perspective is, so if this person's been vomiting a lot, you need to know whether their hydration state's good.
Okay.
So things like whether their mucous membranes are dry, whether they're tachycardic, whether they have low blood pressure, or whether they get a postural blood pressure drop, capillary refill. So all those kind of things are important to ascertain this person's volume state.
Okay.
So that's one thing that you probably want to check.
So is it very easy to get dehydrated from excessive vomiting?
It can be, yeah, certainly, because... And it's, I guess, the more correct terms, volume depletion.
Volume depletion. Well.
So, yes, because not only are they expelling things, but they're not intaking much. So they can certainly get dehydrated.
So you're worried more about the expulsion of the water or the expulsion of the ions within the water?
The electrolyte disturbances are the other thing that you need to be careful of. So just with the physical exam though, you're guided by your history, you know, because you can't examine everything. Because so a neurological exam will take time. An abdominal exam will take time. And so that's why history is really important. History is really the key to, and if you take a good history, 70 to 80% of the time, you're going to know where to look.
Okay.
The physical exam confirms it, and then your investigations confirm that.
Yeah.
And sorry, where were we up to before I...
What was I saying? I was talking about... well, we're about to move on to treatment.
I just had one question. It was going back somewhat. It's going around the enteritis and food poisoning.
Yeah.
And the time... Obviously, for viral, it's much harder to know when you were infected to start it going off. But in terms of, say, bacteria in the food or food poisoning, what, from your experience, is the shortest duration from a ingestion of a bad food into a vomit? Like, can it be as short as a few minutes, or does it take the bacteria to colonize?
I think it can be pretty short, actually. And again, I went on a date once.
you vomit a lot on dates.
we ate some sushi.
And I pretty much hid in this girl's bathroom.
Wow.
And vomited about an hour or two later.
Whoa.
For ages.
That must have been some pretty contaminated sushi.
That was pretty sick.
I've been told by a microbiologist, don't ever eat rice. that's for sale.
Full stop.
They just said don't eat rice and sushi. Don't eat cold rice, basically, they said, because they said bacteria loves cold rice. They just love it. Sugar. Yeah, that's it. Perfect food source for.
I don't think it has to be that long, really.
And I you probably don't know this because it's probably more for a microbiologist, but is it... So if you eat contaminated food, is it the bacteria or is it potentially they've got their toxins in there as well?
Yeah,
I think a lot of the time it's actually the toxins that they produce.
So you could almost kill the bacteria, but if they've released their exotoxins or whatever...
That's probably what's happening, is that your body is killing off the bacteria that probably shouldn't be there.
Then you'll react to the exotoxin.
Yeah, the endo or exotoxins, maybe not endotoxin, but yeah.
Okay.
Or the polysaccharides that are sitting on the outside of the bacteria.
Yeah, okay. All right, so we've done the main potential causes and some of the way you would further diagnose.
Yeah.
You started to talk about, so you said that your main concerns of ongoing vomiting is going to be volume depletion and electrolyte disturbances. Yeah. What about with pH, if someone's vomiting a lot? Because we know that the pH of the stomach is very acidic.
Yeah.
So if you vomit a lot, can you lose a lot of that acid?
Yeah, you can get alkalosis. You can also get, you could also be vomiting because of an acidosis that you have as well, or alkalosis.
Okay, so like...
So like a diabetes. DKA. Oh. Yeah. Actually, DKA is probably one of the other ones that could potentially just present with nausea and vomiting as well. Yeah.
And so the nausea and vomiting would be caused by the excessive hydrogen ions stimulating...
Trigger zones?
Possibly.
Yeah.
Or the ketones.
Maybe the ketones.
I'm not exactly sure about the mechanism. But
the ketones used as an energy source, so presumably...
Ketones get turned back very quickly into glucose, though, once it enters the brain. So maybe not ketones.
Because ketones is an energy source, you wouldn't think that it would
be... But the hydrogen ions produced as a byproduct of ketone production, potentially.
Makes sense.
It might actually be because of the gastroparesis that you get as well from memory.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So why the development of a gastroparesis?
Diabetics can get gastroparetic.
Yeah.
And again, I can't honestly remember the pathophysiology.
But this is where you got diminished gastric emptying, right?
Mm.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Wow. I just would assume it's probably just an overall imbalance happening in the body, just slowing things down.
No, you can. Yeah, don't.
Wow.
But the main concerns really are the volume depletion, which you want to replace.
Okay. Ideally. Sorry, you keep going.
Ideally, orally, but otherwise, if not intravenously.
That was going to be my question. Yeah. So is it just a normal saline, or are you going to put them on something with... like saline with something else in it?
It's usually just normal saline.
Okay.
Yeah.
When do you determine that you're going to put them on a drip, or you're just going to tell them to orally rehydrate?
So a lot of the time, it depends on a few things. It depends how volume depleted they are. So you can make an assessment of, you know, how volume depleted they are. The second thing is how, if they can actually get any oral intake down.
Gotcha.
So, you know, sometimes they're just vomiting so much that they can't actually get anything down, in which case you're not going to die. But in the kids' ED, for example, we've got a fridge full of icy pulls.
Yeah.
Just to see if, you know.
Oh, they'll keep those down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And especially in kids are not some, they're not, you don't want to traumatize them by putting intravenous cannulas in them too much. So it's in children, you want to ideally really try to orally rehydrate them first. Mm. Even in adults, you know, it's ideal. But if you find that they're too volume depleted and you need to replace some volume and you can't do it orally, then intravenous fluids. So you can use saline. Some people like to use Hartmann's.
Yeah.
There's no real evidence at the moment between one or the other,
yeah.
Except for in sepsis.
So is Hartmann's saline with glucose?
It's got different electrolytes, yeah. And it's said to be more physiologically close.
It's got lactate in as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
From memory, yeah.
So one part of the treatment, if dehydrated or volume depleted,
yeah.
would be oral rehydration or IV. What about when it comes to pharmacological management of the nausea and vomiting?
Yeah. Sorry, one other thing I should say is volume depletion plus electrolyte replacement as well. So one of the more serious things that has significant consequences is potassium.
Yeah.
So you want to correct that. Yeah.
And if because obviously I think hydrogen ions and potassium ions love to exchange with one another, and if you're depleting yourself of hydrogen ions through vomiting, this may alter whether the potassium sits intracellularly or extracellularly. And so this could also have an effect, potentially.
Yeah, because potassium derangement, you know, has significant implications for your cardiac.
Mm. So do you do bloods before you do electrolyte rehydration?
You should. Yeah. So if you're going to replace something like potassium, you should know where it's at.
Yeah.
And it's pretty easy these days. You can do a venous blood gas, which sort of at the point of care, you have a result in 30 seconds.
Wow.
Really? So, you know, you have a decent idea. Yeah. And then you send bloods off to the proper lab anyway. Mm. But you have a decent idea. And plus, if that's also happening, you want to do an ECG just to make sure there are no cardiac complications.
So when you do a venous blood gas and you determine the potassium, this is something that I've always wondered about. Obviously, potassium predominantly sits intracellularly. Extracellular, 3.5 millimoles per liter, 4 millimoles per liter, or milliequivalents per liter. If that number is higher, how do you know that it's just the potassium hasn't jumped out of the cell and it's sitting in the extracellular fluid, or whether there's a problem with over-ingestion or a problem with excretion of potassium? Or if the potassium's low in the extracellular fluid, how do you know that, I mean, my question is, how do you know what the overall amount of potassium is within the body? Because that's what's important, right? The overall potassium, because you could do something that alters the shuttling across the cell of the potassium.
You could, yeah. So you could do something like that. I mean, a good example is when you give salbutamol, for example, you know, you can hide it, but then it's going to come creep back out. But what you treat is actually the number that you see on the VBG or the biochemistry panel, or whatever you're using.
Chuck some potassium in.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you need, I mean, it depends on the patient's history, what comorbidities they have, what medications they're on. So then you get then you get a fair idea of what is causing this. Like if they're in DKA, it's going to be a completely different thing.
Yeah.
If they've just had a lot of salbutamol for various reasons, it's another thing. So it depends on their state, and then you can sort of predict what's going to happen. But what you measure is, you know, what you've measured on the bloods is what you manage.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so we've got water, we've got electrolytes. Now, when it comes to the pharmacological intervention, so whether it be for the nausea or the vomiting,
yeah,
what do you do? Do you have, because we stated that there's a number of chemicals that can stimulate vomiting and nausea, and you've also got the afferents coming from the gut, and you've also got perception, and you've also got the vestibular system. How do you know which one you need to treat? Because I assume there's different receptors for each different type. Is there a treat-all drug that you use, or do you have to try and determine where this is coming from?
Yeah. So, I mean, treating the cause is important because that's what's going to fix it, right?
Yeah.
So treating the cause is important, but in the emergency department, so in the emergency setting, there's very little evidence for one drug over the other versus placebo. In fact, there's, almost next to no good evidence.
And so these drugs are predominantly the anti-dopaminergics, anti-serotonin, or dopamine antagonists and serotonin antagonists.
Histamine
antagonists.
Yeah.
So the most commonly used, I guess the two most commonly used ones in practice are metoclopramide or ondansetron.
Yeah.
So ondansetron is a 5-HT3 antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
Serotonin 3 receptor.
Metoclopramide is dopamine. It's a prokinetic as well.
Okay.
So what does that mean?
A dopamine or prokinetic. So it pushes things along the gut.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like, does that mean diarrhea is a common consequence of taking this, or just?
It can be, but I think it's a part of...
It'll make you think it'll make them vomit even more if it's prokinetic.
I think it pushes things along.
In the right direction.
Yeah.
Not in the opposite direction. So what about Parkinson's patients, right? So if dopamine is a stimulator for the vomiting center and they take dopamine precursors as levodopa, which turns to dopamine, would a mismanagement of that, or even just normal management of a Parkinson's patient, result in vomiting? Do you get that?
Yeah, and actually with some of these drugs, especially, you know, metoclopramide in particular, you've got to be really careful of side effects like that. So you can get all these movement.
Dyskinesias.
Yeah, exactly. So you need to be very, very careful.
Yeah. How common is that?
I haven't seen it, but it's a known side effect. Okay. Like it does happen and you need to be mindful of it.
Yeah. Okay. And so do you ever have people coming in with who take serotonin agonists and are vomiting because of their medication that is serotonin agonist?
So like, you know, antidepressants, for example, are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which include... So
that increases the amount of serotonin available at the synapse.
Mm-hmm.
So that could potentially do it?
Potentially.
Potentially make you a bit nauseous, maybe. I personally haven't really seen.
My assumption is it would be managed. I mean, they would know what's causing their vomiting because I assume they know it's a side effect.
And it might be managed in the GP setting.
Yeah.
That
makes sense. So you're saying that the current meds being dopamine antagonists, serotonin antagonists, don't necessarily, there's not enough evidence to suggest that they work better than one another or even placebo in the emergency setting. Yeah. So what do you do to cork the...
cork the
emesis.
Yeah. One drug that does have some evidence for efficacy in that setting is droperidol.
Okay.
So droperidol is another anti-dopaminergic drug. Actually, in certain doses, it's used to sedate people who might be agitated as well. Yeah.
I may have taken something very similar to that by accident when I went on a boat for motion sickness.
Accident.
I took two as opposed to one, and I was knocked out for the 4-hour boat trip. I felt like when people were talking to me that they were coming from a distance. It felt like they were a mile away. I was still vomiting because I don't think it made any difference to my motion sickness. I was just vomiting in this semi-comatose state. It was a horrible 4 hours. It was, I'll never hop on a boat ever again. That's how bad it was.
I think that's also with some of the antihistamines that they use for vomiting. They have a sedation effect, quite strong.
But I guess the bottom line is, you know, in the emergency setting, a lot of these things have poor evidence. Another class of drug is glucocorticoids.
Wow.
So, you know, dexamethasone, for example.
Yeah. So that's a systemic anti-inflammatory, right? That's a pretty strong anti-inflammatory steroid.
Yeah.
So the mechanism is not really clear. And it's thought that it might be due to its anti-inflammatory effects.
So sort of like blunting those chemicals, because a lot of the pro-inflammatory chemicals seem to overlap with the chemicals that stimulate the chemoreceptive trigger zone, so maybe blunting them or stopping them from being transcribed or translated.
You think it would take a while, though?
No, steroids work. So, you know, steroid jumps into the cell, alters transcription, translation. It actually happens super quick. Like, it can happen within 20 to 30 minutes, it can alter translation.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Hmm.
With, actually, so ondansetron and, say, dexamethasone have a bit more evidence in post-operative nausea and vomiting and chemotherapy settings.
So is the post-operative nausea and vomiting, is that due to the anesthetic?
Yeah. Unless, maybe, if it was a GI surgery, it probably would have peritoneal irritation and inflammation.
But the anesthetic.
So it's more so having their effects blocking the anesthetic as opposed to anything else.
But they also give, like, the, if you're going to take a strong opioid, don't they usually give metoclopramide as well?
Yeah, so, you know, morphine, and any of those things.
Like a prophylactic.
Yeah, because they're, they, you know, slow down gastric motility. So that's, with opiates, you might get that as well.
Yeah.
I think it also sensitizes the vestibular system, opioids. So,
and they directly stimulate the chemoreceptive trigger zone. So it's a three-pronged attack from morphine. It stops your bowel from moving around, and then it stimulates the chemoreceptive trigger zone and sensitizes your vestibular system.
Yeah, there you go.
But really, until some of the causes are just, you know, self-limiting, like gastroenteritis.
Yeah.
So they're going
to. Which is what I had. I didn't come and see you in ED. I was thinking about it, but it stopped within 12 hours.
Yeah, well, people, you know, I mean, yeah. So until you really fix the cause, that's probably the best treatment in the emergency setting, or just let it run its course.
Yeah.
So Dinesh has given up dates. So he doesn't vomit anymore. Yeah, he hasn't got any dates.
That's what put me off the whole thing. Yeah, dates maybe vomit. Maybe it is psychogenic.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Wasn't the sushi at all.
Wasn't the sushi at all.
Just the nerves of being on a date. Wasn't the teacups either. So, well, look, I think we've. Is there anything else you'd like to add? So we've spoken about the pathophysiology. We've spoken about, you know, presentation. We've spoken about diagnosis. And we've spoken about treatment. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Would you say it's like one of the top presentations?
It's common. Yeah, it's definitely common.
So we did abdominal pain, which was apparently number one.
It's very common. Yeah.
So would it be numbers.
The most common things you deal with really are chest pain, abdominal pain, and things. But you know, people do present with nausea and vomiting, particularly pregnant women who have intractable nausea and vomiting. You have people with gastroenteritis. You have people, you know, so it can be, because it's very uncomfortable as well. So
it can be horrible. And for me, I pass out.
Yeah, he gets syncope from it.
I get vasovagals.
Oh, jeez.
How good's that?
I just wake up on the ground.
So if it was you on the date, that would be finding you covered in your own spew in the toilet, unconscious.
So, better than getting poo faints.
That's it. You don't get poo faints, do you, Matty?
No, not that. Not yet.
Luckily. Do you get it when you have diarrhea?
No. I ended up in a hospital in Singapore after I visited India. And the specialist came around and goes, look, you could have anything. You just come back from India. He goes, I had a journalist who was in this ward last week, and I think he said that she had three things at once. Oh. She had a bacteria, a virus, and parasite. A protozoa.
Oh.
Like a Guardia or something.
Well, at least you could... Antibiotics will help two of them. And then time will help the third, I suppose.
But mine was a virus. Mm.
So what did he do? Nothing. He was just saline.
It's just
can you do much with the virus? Just let it run its course,
just supportive,
right?
Yeah.
So buscopan was the best one for me because I had a lot of kind of cramping.
Yes.
Mm.
So you needed to let that
really,
go.
I didn't really vomit, but the diarrhea was chronic. Which I'll leave for the when we cover that.
Yes, that's a good way to finish a podcast. Matt had chronic diarrhea. All right, well, Dinesh, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. It's so fun helpful. As always.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's I think we covered vomiting and nausea pretty well.
And Dinesh's dates.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. We'll talk about my dating history in the next episode.
Well, you're a dad now.
So that's no true. So it never existed. So, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Dinesh. Thanks, Maddie.
Thank you.
And that was Dr. Matt, Dr. Mike's medical podcast. We'll see you all soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.